Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Hello, Negotiations Ninja listeners. You've got Mark here from the Negotiations Ninja podcast. Today, my incredible guest is J.N. Wright. He is a professor at McGill University, and we're talking all about the challenges that students have in negotiating job offers when they leave university. So if you're a new grad and you're thinking to yourself, goodness, I wish I had some advice about how to do this and how to approach this and how to think about this, highly recommend this show for you. Enjoy this great interview with J.N. Wright. Good day, good sir. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I am fantastic. I'm really excited to finally have you on the show and talk all about the amazing things that you're doing in the world of negotiation education and what you're noticing with your students and other students around the world of negotiation in higher education. But before we get into that conversation, maybe you could tell the listeners a bit about who you are and what you do.
Sure. So my name is JN. I'm an assistant professor of organizational behavior at McGill University in the Dizotel Faculty of Management. And my research and my teaching are focused on how people can work together efficiently in the world that's more diverse and that's more virtual. And so I do that through research on remote work, and I also teach a lot of negotiation classes, and that's how I got into the negotiation field.
Amazing. For our American listeners, Dizotel School of Management is the business school at McGill, one of the top tier business schools in Canada, sort of like our Ivy League, so to speak. Let's get into the conversation. So now, when you're teaching your students, it seems to me, and this was sort of based on the discussion that we had a while ago, that negotiation comes with a bit of baggage for them. They approach it very hesitantly. Why do you suppose that is?
So it's really interesting because I was convinced when I started teaching negotiation in our business school 5 years ago or 6 years ago, I was convinced students would be kind of the shark type, the finance shark type we always see in business schools, and would be really interested in being maybe becoming aggressive negotiators or having very competitive outcomes. And in reality, the switch I've seen over the past 10 years in academia and business schools and the switch I've seen in my classroom is they don't really want to be sharks anymore. They care a great deal about collaborating and win-win outcomes. And I think a lot of them, what they want through a negotiation class is to know how to ask for things and to know how to be able to make a case for it and hopefully get it. And so it's a lot more practical and a lot more down to earth than I thought, because I really thought they all would be extremely excited at the idea of negotiating, where in reality, most of them tend to avoid negotiations and are trying to be more comfortable with it.
There's a couple things there that I want to dig into. Number one is how to ask for things. I want to dive into that. But first, I want to address why they avoid negotiations. And I've seen this a lot in younger students that I teach in negotiation as well that come into new sales teams or new procurement teams. There's a hesitancy to negotiate. Yeah. And I was quite surprised by that, actually. Why do you suppose that is?
I think especially for younger people, and that's what you see when they get to the MBA level or the executive MBA level, they're more comfortable negotiating. But especially for a young person, it's very difficult to become assertive because they've been raised to be compliant. And so they've been raised to basically do everything their parents tell them and then the school teacher tells them. And then they arrive at university and I'm telling them, now it's not time to be compliant. Now it's time to be assertive and cooperative. And I think a lot of them have an issue with this because they don't really see how they can do it. And so to them, they have no functional way of being assertive. And so it's either compliance or it's becoming aggressive and upset. And I think none of these two options are really satisfying to them. And so they're looking for a third one, which would be, how about just asking and be assertive and make my case for it?
So when you're taking them through sort of the transformation that is required of them to become more assertive and to ask, how do you start that journey? Because I can imagine if you've had a lifetime of compliance and you've had a lifetime of acquiescing to someone else's requests, How do you start the transformative journey that's required to become at least competent in negotiation?
So it's an interesting question. And I think one of the aspects that works really well with students is to have them do negotiation simulations or negotiation outside in real life, and then show them how they compare to everybody else. And because if you avoid a negotiation or if you comply with whatever you're told, it's easy to be okay with it because you don't really know what else you could have gotten. To you, you just like, you saved yourself from a difficult situation. You didn't get what you wanted, but maybe you couldn't have gotten it anyway, or maybe there was nothing to get anyway. But when I do it in class, we use an online platform that's called iDecision Game, which is very popular in negotiation classes, but I can show everyone what score they got. And especially for quantitative negotiations, it's very interesting because you can see that some teams are better at discovering all the points and expanding the pie for both, while others are just completely dysfunctional and end up having a subpar outcome. And so once you can see, like, wait a minute, this is the score that I got, this is what my skills are giving me in this situation, what about in life? Like, what is it going to do to me in life? And so I think once students really have no way of denying that they're missing out, that there is something they're not doing properly, then it's all about taking the risk. And there is always a risk. So then I want them to take the jump, right? How are you going to start being assertive, negotiating? How are you going to be more comfortable with all of this? And I think that the risk will always be there, in the sense that you always have a risk that the other person gets upset, or a risk that you don't get what you want. But if you have a method, then the risk is really calculated. If you have a method on determining what you want, if you have a method on preparing for it, if you have a method on what kind of persona are you going to be in that negotiation? Who are you going to be to that person? And if you've tried that several times and now you have a persona that's not confrontational, but that's still assertive, then you're really not taking a lot of risk. And also, you don't have to come up with anything. All of it you've already done before. All of it is prepared. It's really just about a simple asking for something, listening to what the other party said, making a counter argument, and then that's it. That's all you have to do.
I'm going to take us down a road which may cause us to question the design of learning to begin with. Isn't it interesting that no one throughout their entire schooling career of K to 12, whatever it might be, ever gets taught negotiation or like broad level communication skills, how to have a debate? I mean, there are debate clubs and all the rest of it. But how to have civil debate, or how to negotiate, or how to express your point or advocate for your needs. There is, along with financial literacy and all these other kinds of things, I find it very interesting. And the conspiracy theorist in me, like, definitely raises red flags whenever I'm like, why is that? Why do you suppose that is? And maybe I'll ask the question to you is, why do you suppose that the learning institutions that we have, public schooling, private schooling, don't teach these critical skills for life?
Yeah, I mean, it's very disturbing because, especially if you're thinking about children and teenagers, I mean, give them tools to express what they want. Give them tools to make a logical argument as to why they should get it. Like, it's going to help them so much more instead of them becoming upset or just avoidant. I think one of the main reasons this is not taught, it's because the vast majority of the population, I'd say 70% of the population, is extremely uncomfortable with conflicting goals. If you want to reach a goal and another party wants to reach another goal, and these goals are incompatible, then you have a conflict. And that could be anything. That could be tidying up your room if you're a kid. That could be applying for a job and wanting to be paid more. All of these are conflicts. And for some reason, we have internalized, the majority of the general population has internalized, that in these situations, the only way forward is compliance. It's to do whatever you're told, to comply with the person who's telling you to do something, even though you're not happy with it. And so here is why it doesn't work. It doesn't work because if you comply and instead of asking for what you want, you just do what you're told, you're not doing your work as a negotiator. You're not doing the work of reducing the conflict. What you're doing is you're letting the conflict fester because you will be upset. I've run studies on this. People who avoid negotiations and comply with whatever they're told, they are upset about it. They're not happy about it. They are happy for like 2 seconds. And then once they realize they have the deal and now that's it, and they start being upset and being regretful. So if you're a manager, you also have to know that, which is that when people say yes, it doesn't mean they're on board. A lot of them just say yes just to make you go away because they have no clue how to deal with it. I see that in my class all the time, where I ask students for feedback and I say, what about this? What do you think about that? And I have students who tell me like, I'm so sorry, I couldn't answer in class, or here's my email. I was too worried of like retaliation, or I was too worried of looking stupid, or I was too worried about giving my advice to a professor. I mean, in my opinion, we're all equal. We're all the same thing. We're just in like different contexts. So if you have something to ask, and then just learn how to do it assertively, but politely, and there really shouldn't be anything wrong happening after that.
Yeah. For me, and it's sort of how I try to teach my own children. I have two little boys. They're 5 and 7. And this is difficult as a parent because you need compliance in your kids a lot of the time. But teaching your kids to question why something is a certain way, I found to be like a really good first step. So when I say, hey, you need to do this, and then they say, well, why? And then I have to explain to them why they need to do that. And for them, they need to logically now figure out, okay, does this align with what I actually need or want? And is this something that I need to chat with someone about? I think that could be a way to do that. But then again, the school system was designed not to train independent thinkers. It was to train essentially factory workers back in the day, right? So it wasn't designed to create independent thought. It was designed to create compliance.
And also creating independent thought is a skill of its own, right? It's like it's already something else. Like it goes beyond the curriculum that a school teacher covers. So it's really interesting. I think when people ask you why about something, about a decision, the worst thing to do is to tell them like, just because I said so.
Or well, I've definitely had to do that as a parent because I can't come up with a reason.
Yeah, you can't come up with anything. And so the issue here, people care a great deal about fairness. So we discussed about this last time we talked, but as a child, I was very non-compliant and I was always asking why, and I was always responding back to teachers and not doing what I'm told. Not because I was a rebel, but just because if you wanted me to do something, you had to convince me first. Otherwise, I'm just not going to do it. And I think from the perspective of someone like me, trying to force me to do something is weak. It's poor argument. You're not going to get me to buy in. You're not going to get me to be okay with it or do a good job. All you're going to get me to do is like malicious compliance or just a way of like just making you go. So to circle back on what you were saying, I agree. I think negotiation and conflict resolution should be a focus in high school as early as possible for children and teenagers, because conflict costs us billions of dollars a year.
Big time.
Conflicts in organizations is extremely expensive. Let me just give you an example. On the job market, people typically don't negotiate their salaries. Doesn't mean they don't want to. They want to, but they don't. So the reason organizations don't want to negotiate salaries with employees for most employees is that it's a lot of work. They don't want to have to do this and have special treatment for everyone. But from the perspective of the employee, if you manage to get them to sign and you kind of shut down any attempt to negotiate, they're not happy about it. They don't think they got treated fairly. And when people think they're treated unfairly, this is when they get demotivated. You increase the turnover. People quit. So nobody's winning here. And this is why, like, I'm thinking, even if compliance from your subordinate sounds like something that's a good thing, it's typically not. You want your subordinates to do what you're telling them because they believe it's the right thing to do. So I always say, you can negotiate anything with me. I just have to be convinced. If I'm convinced, I'll do it. I'm not convinced, I won't do it. And people are okay not getting what they want as long as they understand why they're not getting it. They understand why that would be unfair for them to get it.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about another company that I run called Content Callout. It is a thought leadership brand marketing company. Now, what does that mean? It means that we take you as an executive or entrepreneur, a leader of a small or medium-sized business, and we turn you into a thought leader online. We take your personal brand and we amp it up to 11. so that you can lead with confidence, knowing that people will recognize you, recognize your brand, and recognize your business because of the thought leadership approach that you've taken on social media through content creation and content distribution, as well as engaging with all of your following online. How do you get involved in this? Easy, easy, easy. Just go to contentcallout.com/get-started, and you will see there three different options that will allow you to take your thought leadership brand for yourself and for your business to the next level. We are super excited to talk to you about this. We've seen some massive growth with the businesses that we've been working with. Very, very exciting time for us. Look at that. We appreciate it. Now back to your show. I was reading an article once, and don't ask me to cite it. I can't remember where it was, but it said something to the effect of approximately 70 to 71% of people don't negotiate their salaries. And they went into this article went into the details around the difference between negotiating for an extra $5,000 or $10,000 and what the end result of that person's wage would be at the end of their career compared to someone who didn't negotiate for their salary. And the difference was hundreds of thousands of dollars at the end of it, because they could ideally contribute towards something that was compounding and make more money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the end result of negotiating is substantially better than not negotiating. And is it that logical, like once people get it, they're like, oh, I see why now I should negotiate. They see the end result. Is that something that helps them to push them over the edge of like, okay, now I should start?
I think it's understanding that something is risky, but really worth it.
Right.
And you may not get it. It's a little bit of a risk. And we don't take that many risks with such important things in life. So I agree with you. It's a huge number of people don't negotiate because they don't feel like it. And so typically it's because they're scared of one, looking greedy, and two, of having the offer rescinded. And I hear that a couple of times a week. I'm not sure where this comes from because it's never been a practice in organizations, and I've run studies on it. Also asking people, have you ever had an offer rescinded after negotiating? It's not happened. But people are very scared of this. And so I think they inflate the fear related to negotiating. And because they have no skill to tackle that, they just feel like they're incompetent and they can't do it. So they need to learn that competence. And so to connect it back to just a few thousand dollars at the beginning of the career that can have a huge impact, I agree with you. I remember like a few years ago, I think it was the first time I was teaching in our MBA, I had a student at the beginning of the semester who came to me to apologize for being a terrible negotiator. And he was like telling him, I'm so sorry. I just want you to know, like, I'm going to do terrible this year. I'm really not social. Like, this is not my thing. I'm kind of a shy person. I want to get into coding and that kind of stuff. And so I was very surprised that he would say that. But I told him, like, it's a method. Everybody can become a good negotiator. So just do the method and you'll do fine. And by the end of the semester, he had negotiated his first job with a $15,000 a year increase.
Amazing.
Just $15,000. From the guy who was like coming and apologizing for being a terrible negotiator. And I remember he was like so excited and so happy to tell me. And I was telling him, like, you changed the arc of your life. This is not going to be the same. You already have an extra $1,000 a month in your bank account. Like, this is not even going to stop there. All of that is going to accumulate. But not just that. Now that you've obtained it, you will know that you can get good things by negotiating. And so this thing about people who negotiate, people who don't, research finds that it's a lot of times men who tend to negotiate and women don't tend to negotiate. And I've seen this. I typically don't like to talk too much about gender differences because it's a little bit like from the 70s, the research from the 70s. But 85% of my students are women. And I hear kind of like the same thing over and over, which is that I have very bright young women who do explain to me that if they do good work, they will receive a raise. They don't need to negotiate. And you see them 2 years later and you ask them if they got a raise and they're like, no, I need to quit and change jobs. And the reality is, if you don't negotiate before signing the contract, well, you have no leverage anymore.
Yeah.
It's over.
This is such good advice. I really want to dig into this because so many people are so afraid of negotiating prior to the contract. They're like, oh, let me work through a year and prove myself and then I'll ask for a raise. And yes, you should be doing that as well.
Yeah.
But prior to you signing the deal, that's when you have the most leverage in that relationship, because they need you. And now you're in a leverage-based position. And so you to not utilize that to your advantage is a major miss that most people miss.
I really agree with you. I think it's a major miss. And I think it's because people typically focus on the job market. They only think up until the point where they're getting their first offer.
Right.
And they don't really think about what's going to happen after. So the story of my life is receiving emails from former students from other classes who are telling me, oh my God, like tomorrow morning, I have this like negotiation. They made me an offer. What can I do? And I'm like, what other offers do you have? And they're like, none. And so I tell them like, well,
you
already.
Teach them about BATNA and you're like, okay, remember yeah. when we went over this in class?
Yeah. So your BATNA would be unemployment now. That's great. So, I mean, no, so they're not negotiation students, but they're like from organizational behavior, right. but they know I teach negotiation. But it's, I think the reality about negotiation is it's more simple than people think it is. It takes more work than people think it is. It's not hard work. It's simple work, but you have to do it. It means like you need to have as many offers as you can.
Right.
And you need to enrich these offers to see how good of a deal you can get. You need to prepare and have information about what the market is paying. So it means you need to have several meetings with people who know that information. You need to find these people. So a lot of times I'm going to tell that to a student. I'm going to say, what salary are you asking for? Which is, by the way, completely insane. But the number of people that I meet and they're like so terrified about a negotiation, they don't even know how much they want to be paid.
Right.
And you're like saying, of course you're terrified. I mean, yeah. are you kidding? Like you're going to
be terrified as well if I had no idea.
Yeah. I mean, like, how are you supposed to defend yourself? How are you supposed to get a good deal? You don't even know what a good deal is. Right.
Yeah.
And so it's really this thing where I tell them like, yeah, I mean, you need to go to the careers office and ask them for data. You need to go on Glassdoor. You need to ask for alumni information. You need to ask your friends. Like it's a guesstimation task. You're not going to get the actual number, but you're supposed to get as close as possible. And sometimes they say, oh, but I don't have time to do this in like an hour. And I'm like, yeah, no joking. Of course you don't. Like, this is a serious process that takes a bit of time. It's not hard. Like, I really believe anybody can do it. But you just have to take the time to actually do it. And for some reason, I mean, I think everybody should know how to do this. I think it's not that crazy to teach people, hey, so if you want something, like first, it's to determine that you really want it. Then second, it's to kind of think about what alternative you have. And like, I mean, it's just simple. It would solve so many issues because then people don't have to be upset, or then people don't have to be avoidant or compliant. They can just negotiate or say what they want and then say yes, no, and that's it. You know, we have a deal.
Yeah. One of the things that you mentioned at the beginning of our discussion was getting them to practice, getting your students yeah. to practice. I mean, you guys use iDecision, very popular software amongst yeah. a lot of MBA programs that teach negotiation. What about outside of school? How would you get them to like approach difficult conversations? Is there a way that you would get them to practice?
Yeah. So I created a few years ago this contest that I run every year in my undergrad classes and my MBA classes, which is called a Master Negotiators Contest. And I put my students in teams of 3 or 4, and they have to compete against all the other teams to negotiate as many things outside of class for real money as possible.
Awesome.
And so the goal is they can do so many things. In Canada, you can really renegotiate your cell phone. You can renegotiate like your salary pretty easily. I mean, there's tons of things, your insurance, tons of things you can negotiate. And in addition to that, you can go on websites like Kijiji or Craigslist. You can buy something cheap, sell it for more expensive. I mean, it's all about getting practice to negotiate. Last year, I had just one section during COVID-19, and they created a surplus of $30,000, meaning
good for them.
Like that's just the amount in total that they saved or made through negotiation. All of it is taken care of by my TA. I show them tallies every week. The goal is really to create some sort of an incentive to show that, see, other people are making their lives a lot better. Like, why aren't you doing it? Why are you the only one that's not doing it? And so I think that really motivates them a lot. And it's interesting because when I started this a few years ago, I had a few students who were pushing back on it and who were telling me, like, I could see that they were becoming upset about it. And they were like telling me like, well, I don't have time for this. Or like, what do you think? I'm just going to go and negotiate like outside of class. I've already so much work, right? And to me, that was the signal that it was exactly working, because it was just pushing the button that I wanted to push, which is you're scared, aren't you? Like, that's what's happening. You're scared of it. And this is not going away. Like, just jump in the pool, do it. And they do it ultimately. And to them, I've seen students sell like their parents' house. I've seen students like help their father negotiate their new car. Like, I've seen students do all sorts of things. So that's what I do. Another one, I'm teaching this summer MBA class and we can't really do it this way. So what I told my students is, because they were like, oh, we can't, it's in Japan. And they were like telling me, oh, we can't really negotiate for money in Japan. And so I think they're trying to like get away from it because it's stressful to go negotiate for real money. It's very stressful. Totally. And so I was telling them, like, I'm pretty sure each of you has like a conflict at work that's not resolved. Something with someone where it just like it's not good and you need to do something and you've been avoiding it or complying with it. And now you're going to solve it. And so that's what they work on during that semester, because I want them to be able to say, it gives them an incentive in the sense that everybody would prefer not to have an extra conflict.
Yes.
And also it gives them the tools. And so I think that helps. But I agree with you. Simulations are very interesting and they're very useful because they're standardized. You can compare students one from the other. It's really well made and the scenarios are great. But it's kind of like just case analysis. It's not the same thing as real life. At some point, I need to teach you how to use all of that knowledge that you developed in simulation and use it for real outside of class for a real skill. And that was very important to me because I don't want to teach like a history of negotiation class or a theory of negotiation class. I really want to teach a negotiation class. So I want you to like get better at negotiating.
I love it. I think it's amazing. And this is where I think the rubber hits the road for a lot of students. They need a safe place that they can practice in. And then they need the ability to take what they've practiced in that safe place and put it into practice where there's some risk. And there's, if they don't get it wrong, they don't get the money. Or maybe they lose a little bit of money. And there needs to be that risk component for them to fully realize their potential and realize what they can gain out of it. And I love that you have put into place a competition that conceptualizes and crystallizes that for them so that they can do it in the real world. Brilliant. This has been an incredible conversation, and I want to do a part two with you because I want to get into a discussion around where you see negotiation going as a concept, because I think the word negotiation comes with a lot of baggage because of the conflict that's associated with it. But I want to save that for round two. Sure. Where do people find you? If they want to reach out to you online, if they want to find you online, how do they do that?
So you can go on rate.net, which is my website, reyt.net, and you can see all of my socials, and I have a negotiation newsletter on it. That's the Master Negotiator newsletter. So that's the best way to find me. And you can then find me on LinkedIn or Twitter or Instagram, all that stuff.
I love what you're doing, man. I love that we have people like you in the great country of Canada teaching great negotiation skills to students because they really do need it. As we said at the beginning of the conversation, they've missed out on so much. From K to 12, that now they've almost got to play catch up in a lot of situations. And without people like you, it would become very difficult for them to be able to do that. So thank you for doing what you do. Thank you for teaching good negotiation skills to these people because they really do need it. And thank you for being here today and sharing your wisdom.
Thank you so much, Mark, for having me.
Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.